Chapter 45. Roberto Cassano and Angelo Mancini had been in the area 3 whole days, and they figured their one real, solid gold advantage over Mahmani's crew was their local knowledge. They knew the lay of the land. Literally. Most of all, they knew it was flat and empty, like a gigantic pool table with brown felt. Big fields, for efficiency's sake. No ditches, no hedges, no other natural obstacles, the ground frozen firm and hard. So even though their car was a regular street sedan, they could drive it cross-country without a major problem, pretty much like sailing a small boat on a calm open sea. And they had seen the Duncan compound up close. They had been in it. They knew it well. They could loop around behind it in the car, slow and quiet, lights off, inky blue and invisible in the dark, and then they could get out and climb the crappy post and rail fence and storm the place from the rear. Surprise was everything. There might be eyeballs to the front, but in back there would be nothing at all except the Duncans and Mahmani's guys all sitting around in one of the kitchens, probably toasting each other with cheap bourbon and sniggering about their newly streamlined commercial arrangements. 2 handgun rounds would take care of that happy conversation. Cassano came south on the 2-lane and switched off his lights, level with the motel. The Ford was still burning in the lot, but only just. The remains of the tires were still giving off coils of greasy rubber smoke, and small flames were licking out of the gravel all around where oil had spilled. Safir's boys were dark, shrunken shapes about half their original size, both fused to the zigzag springs that were all that was left of the seats, their mouths forced open like awful shrieks, their heads burned smooth, their hands up like talons. Mancini smiled, and Cassano rolled slowly past them, and headed on down the road, cautiously, navigating by the light of the moon. 4 miles south of the motel, and 1 mile north of the Duncan place, he slowed some more and turned the wheel and bumped across the shoulder and struck out across the open land. The car lurched and pattered. In a geological sense, the ground was dead flat, but down there where the rubber met the dirt, it was rutted and lumpy. The springs creaked and bounced, and the wheel jumped and chattered in Cassano's hands. But he made steady progress. He kept it to about 20 miles an hour and held a wide curve, aiming to arrive about 1/2 mile behind the compound. 2 minutes, he figured. At one point he had to brake hard and steer around a bramble thicket. Just beyond it, they saw the burned-out shell of an SUV. It loomed up at them out of the dark, all black and ashen gray. Reacher's work from earlier in the day. But after that it was easy, all the way. They could see a pool of faint yellow light ahead, like a homing beacon. A kitchen window, almost certainly, spilling warmth. The southernmost house, probably. Jacob Duncan's place. The Big Cheese. Mahmani's man climbed out of the Cadillac and stood for a second in the nighttime cold. He looked all around, east, west, north, south, and he saw nothing stirring. He closed his door to kill the interior light. He took a step toward the trunk. He had been right. There was a light in the trunk. It was throwing a pale sphere of yellow glow into the mist. Not serious from the front, but a problem from behind. The human eye was very sensitive. He took another step, past the rear passenger door, and he raised his left hand, palm flat, somehow already feeling the familiar sensations associated with an action he had performed 1,000 times before, his palm on the metal, maybe 1 foot from the edge of the lid, so that the force of his push would act on both hinges equally, so that the panel would not buckle, so that both calibrated springs would stretch together with soft creaks, whereupon the lid would go down smooth and easy until the upmarket mechanism grabbed at it and sucked it all the way shut. He got as far as putting his palm on the panel. Subconsciously, he leaned into the motion, not really intending to slam the lid, not at all bad-tempered, just seeking a little physical leverage, and his change of position hunched his shoulders a little, which brought his head forward a little, which changed his eye line a little, which meant he had to look somewhere, and given the choice of the lit interior of a previously closed space or a featureless length of dark blacktop, well, any human eye would opt for the former over the latter. Oscar Arad Sapur stared back at him. His sightless eyes were wide open, his olive skin was pale with death, and yellow in the light. Forces from braking and accelerating and turning had jammed him awkwardly into the far rear corner of the trunk. His limbs were in disarray, his neck was bent, his look was quizzical. Mahmani's man stood absolutely still, his hand on the cold metal, his mouth open, not really breathing, his heart hardly beating. He forced himself to look away, then he looked back. He wasn't hallucinating. Nothing had changed. He started breathing again. Then he started panting. His heart started thumping. He started to shake and shiver. Oscar Arad Sapur stared up at him. Mahmani's man took his hand off the trunk lid and shuffled all the way around to the rear of the car. He stood there with the idling exhaust pooling around his knees and with his fingers steepled against his forehead, looking down, not understanding. Oscar was stone dead, but there was no blood. No gunshot wound between the eyes, no blunt force trauma, no caved-in skull, no signs of strangulation or suffocation, no knife wounds, no defensive injuries. Nothing at all, except his friend, dead in the trunk, all slack and undignified, all thrown about and jumbled up.